From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Saudi leaders today. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman says of the kingdom's relationship with the U.S., quote, "We face our challenges together, the past, the day of, tomorrow." Well, that relationship is facing renewed scrutiny and criticism following the disappearance and reported killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It's a relationship based on oil, on a deep mutual distrust of Iran, and billions of dollars in business deals. So this hour on Point, Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance and its impact on U.S.-Saudi relations. And you can join us. How do you think the U.S. should react to Khashoggi's disappearance? What does the U.S. gain from its steadfast support of Saudi Arabia as one of the central players in America's Middle East strategy? What does the U.S. lose from that same support? And is it time to rethink Washington's relationship with the House of Saud? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we're going to start today in Istanbul, Turkey, with David Kirkpatrick. He's international correspondent for The New York Times. We have a link to his latest story. It's headlined Jamal Khashoggi's Disappearance, What We Know and Don't Know. That link is at On Point Radio. David, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Good to talk to you.
So first of all, tell us, what do we know about what the latest is in terms of what's happening in Istanbul at the Saudi consulate there? We're seeing that Turkish officials have been allowed inside the consulate. What's happened since then?
There is a report from the Associated Press that I haven't been able to confirm independently that prosecutors are saying they found some evidence that Jamal Khashoggi was killed inside the consulate, that a murder took place there. That's becoming less and less controversial as the Saudi Arabian authorities have shifted their story.
I see.
They no longer appear to be denying that anything happened to Jamal Khashoggi while he was in the consulate. Now they're shifting to he was killed there, but it was a kind of rendition gone wrong. It was an interrogation or rendition that went horribly awry.
Mm.
And so that seems to be the state of play.
Okay, so I'm seeing here the Associated Press report that you were referring to. Again, this is from the AP, that high-level Turkish officials say police have found, quote, certain evidence during their search of the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. David, step back here with us for a second and just walk us through Turkey's role in all this. I mean, obviously, this incident took place in Turkey, in Istanbul, early reports of what may have happened to Khashoggi came from Turkish media and Turkish officials. But what role does Turkey play here, and how important are they to this case?
Yeah, that's the big question. So all that we know, really, about the details of what happened to Jamal Khashoggi has come from unnamed Turkish officials, speaking to journalists, including myself. And the information that they have provided is at times quite graphic about his killing and dismemberment. They've even leaked to the Turkish press and also to me the names of 15 Saudis who they say flew into Istanbul on two private jets that day for the purpose of killing Jamal Khashoggi. They have not disclosed their evidence to the public in detail, and they apparently have not disclosed it to Western intelligence services either. And that has raised a lot of questions about whether or not they would be open to, the Turkish authorities, to some kind of an accommodation with Saudi Arabia. That if Saudi Arabia were to say, all right, we acknowledge something horrible happened here and Jamal Khashoggi was killed, but we have an explanation that we would like to put forward, will the Turks try to challenge that? Or will they proceed in this case as partners with Saudi Arabia? Right now, that appears to be the way things are going. As the Turkish police inspectors went into the consulate yesterday afternoon after nearly a two-week wait, they did so following a team of Saudis and in tandem with the Saudis. So it looks like the two countries may be heading to line up their stories.
I see. And so what is it that, I mean, is Turkey looking to gain some leverage over Saudi Arabia or use this as this incident as a way to further influence its relationship with Washington? I mean, walk us through that that question.
You know, I can't really get in the mind of the Turkish president, Recep Erdogan. It's a complicated relationship because clearly the Turkish leadership was very enthusiastic about the Arab Spring. It sees itself as a champion of sort of election-minded Islamists around the region.
Mm-hmm.
Saudi Arabia is on the opposite end of an ideological divide across the region. Saudi Arabia was the kind of anchor of the team of countries that did its best to suppress those uprisings and considers that kind of political Islam to be anathema. So clearly there's no love lost between the leaders of the two countries, and yet they're both important regional powers that kind of feel the need to get along. And to date, they've both done their best to try to maintain good relations, even when it might have seemed awkward. So it wasn't obvious that Turkey would be trying to inflame this incident more than it needed to, and it might have some incentives now to cool things down.
I see. Well, David Kirkpatrick, joining us today from Istanbul, Turkey. He's international correspondent for The New York Times. David, thank you so very much.
Good to talk to you.
All right. Well, let's listen back to what President Donald Trump had to say about this just yesterday. Here he is speaking to reporters on the White House lawn, saying that he had spoken to the King of Saudi Arabia about the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi.
The king firmly denied any knowledge of it. He didn't really know. Maybe, I don't want to get into his mind, but it sounded to me like maybe these could have been rogue killers. Who knows? We're going to try getting to the bottom of it very soon. But his was a flat denial.
That's President Donald Trump just yesterday. Well, joining us now is Stephen Cook. He's Senior Fellow for Middle East and African Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We have a link to his recent article for Foreign Policy headlined, Jamal Khashoggi's Disappearance is Even Stranger Than It Seems. And that link is at onpointradio.org. Stephen Cook, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meg.
Also with us today is Bernard Haeckel. He's a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University and director of Princeton's Institute for Transregional Study of the Contemporary Middle East. Bernard Haeckel, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, gentlemen, I just wonder if we can just take a step back here, because I've been reading all sorts of articles, seeing commentators on television saying that this may be one of the most consequential moments in U.S.-Saudi history, at least recently. Now, why is that? Because there, you know, there have been reasons for tension prior to this. But what's so unique and so causing the tension in this moment in particular? Stephen Cook.
Well, I think there's three reasons why this is such a big story and why commentators are saying that this is a potential juncture in U.S.-Saudi relations, I should say. One is that Jamal Khashoggi was a columnist for The Washington Post, the hometown newspaper for people who make the news and who spend a lot of time thinking about the news. The allegations against Saudi Arabia are grisly, as David Kirkpatrick outlined. And so it has created a sense of outrage and fear among the many journalists who work inside the Beltway and who have spent a lot of time around the world. I think the second reason why it's become such a big story is that the Trump administration, for better or worse, has really identified itself with the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Now, American presidents have long had special relationships with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has long been a pillar of U.S. foreign policy. But there is something about the current political environment and the president and the president's outreach to Saudi Arabia and the crown prince, where there is a certain kind of political aspect to what's going on. And then finally, I think most consequentially, is if, in fact, this was a brutal, grisly murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the Istanbul consulate of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and ordered by the crown prince, it raises questions about the leadership of Saudi Arabia, about their ability to think through the consequences of their actions, or how much control they have over what's going on, if in fact it is rogue elements, which seems sort of absurd, but that may in fact be the story that the Saudis, Turks, and American governments agree on.
Right. Okay. So Bernard Haeckel, Stephen Cook has provided us with three very rich veins to explore here. I just want to get your view on them. Let me hit that first one first, because I want to just get that head on. I mean, Stephen Cook said part of the reason why is that Khashoggi was was a columnist for the Washington Post. Lots of journalists have traveled the same routes as he had. They may care more now. I mean, I'm not sure that says great things about American journalism, because aren't there a myriad other reasons to care about what's going on with the House of Saud and in the region? I mean, we have lots of commenters on our website saying Yemen, Yemen, Yemen.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I mean, these journalists have also focused on Yemen,
yeah,
and have covered that war and have pointed out the killing, especially of the of young people, young children, the cholera epidemic, you know, the fact that it's the worst humanitarian crisis in the world and that the Saudis have contributed to this, if not, you know, inflamed the situation there. So I don't think that's been missing at all. And I agree with David that the fact that this man was is seen as a journalist, and that was certainly one of the things he was, you know, creates, you know, a bond and a brotherhood with other journalists. And if the story is true that he was killed and dismembered and so on, it's horrific, and it rallies his colleagues to him. But it's also true that, you know, for instance, in Turkey, and David knows this, that, you know, tens of thousands of journalists and academics have been put in prison, have been badly treated, have lost their jobs and so on. And, you know, they've received some commentary, but certainly nothing like this. And I think to really understand it, you have to go on to the other explanations that they've provided, namely the personal connection to Trump, to President Trump and to Jared Kushner, as well as to the fact that, you know, Saudi Arabia looks like it's run by someone who is not competent.
Well, we will explore those in just a moment. And Bernard Haykel, forgive me, but Stephen Cook is the other gentleman with us today. David Kirkpatrick was the New York Times reporter in Istanbul, but you're a patriot here on the program today is Stephen Cook. We're talking about renewed scrutiny of U.S.-Saudi relations following the case of what happened to journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about renewed scrutiny on U.S.-Saudi relations following the disappearance and reported killing of journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi. I'm joined today by Stephen Cook. He's a senior fellow for Middle East and African Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And also joined today by Bernard Haykel, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Professor Haykel, before the break, you said it's worth exploring further this question of President Trump's relationship with the House of Saud. And perhaps we should even focus on Jared Kushner and his relationship with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. I mean, how would you describe how close they are?
Well, you probably know that the first overseas trip that President Trump took was to Riyadh.
Yes.
Where he was feted and received, you know, as a great kind of international statesman. And he, you know, seemed to appreciate that a lot. And then a special relationship developed with the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and to deal with a whole series of topics. One was the fight against ISIS and the counterterror campaign. The other was the Israel-Palestinian peace process. And lastly was the relationship, the business and economic relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. And this was at a time when the Saudis were and still are reforming and diversifying their economy. They wanted to invest in the United States. They wanted to buy a lot of things from the U.S. and build strong connections with U.S. institutions, banks, universities, etc. So that relationship is a very personal and tight one. And I think, and this is my speculation, but I think that a significant amount of the attention and anger that has been directed at Saudi Arabia has to do with the feelings that many Americans feel about President Trump.
Okay. Well, Stephen Cook, though, the president has said that he would vow, quote, severe punishment, right, if Saudi Arabia is proven to be behind the death of Khashoggi. But at the same time, the president has said he doesn't want that punishment to affect arms sales, for example, at least $10 billion in arms sales to the Saudi government. So what position does this put the president in?
Well, the president's certainly been all over the place on this issue, as you point out. I think his statements have been an effort to provide time for the Turks and the Saudis to figure out a story. I think it's abundantly clear that the president is in an awkward position, and his inclination is actually to continue the relationship with Saudi Arabia uninterrupted. I think that the statement about severely punishing the Saudis was something where the White House was acknowledging the pressure and 2 weeks full of commentary about the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi. But overall, this is a president who has not made human rights a priority, and has looked upon Washington's relations with other countries, particularly countries in the Middle East and particularly Saudi Arabia, as very important for American commercial transactions. And he has mentioned a $110 billion arms deal, which actually was not struck by the Trump administration, but was actually agreed to under the Obama administration, right, but signed after President Trump came into office.
Yeah. And I appreciate the correction that I had said $10 billion, but you're right. It's a $110 billion arms deal. But to that point, Stephen Cook, I mean, we can talk about the economic ties between Saudi Arabia and the United States, but there are also strategic, really deep strategic elements to this long-standing relationship between these two countries. I mean, how essential of an ally is Saudi Arabia in the region, and does that sort of essential nature make it? Is that the thing that has allowed multiple administrations to talk about human rights on one hand, but overlook human rights violations by the Saudis on the other?
Well, that has long been the dilemma for American policymakers when looking at Saudi Arabia, as well as, quite frankly, other countries in the Middle East. And Saudi's importance, it really depends on how you look at the Middle East right now. Given the fact that the Trump administration regards Iran as its number one priority in countering Iranian influence around the region, then Saudi Arabia is critically important to the United States. You've had Egypt, which has lurched from one crisis to another, really can't project power around the region. Many of the other countries are too small to play a leading role as America's ally. They can be part of an American regional order, but Saudi Arabia really is the big country. It's the custodian of the two holy mosques, which gives it a certain legitimacy in the Muslim world. It is a large producer of oil. It's not the largest any longer. The United States is. But still, many of Washington's most important allies or trading partners do rely upon oil from Saudi Arabia. And the fact that the United States is interested in a global capitalist order, the fact that the Chinese, the Koreans, the Japanese, the Indians are all dependent upon oil coming out of this region and significant portions of it coming from Saudi Arabia – the United States has a compelling interest in Saudi Arabia's stability and supporting Saudi Arabia's security.
Well,
I think.
Oh, sorry. I just want to get I just want to get Bernard Haykel's view in on this. So, for Professor Haykel, for as long as there's this unified approach between the between Washington and Riyadh in terms of their view of the Iranian threat, does that make it impossible to imagine a significant break between these two countries, between the United States and Saudi Arabia?
I think it is impossible, and I've described the relationship as a structural relationship, not a transactional one, even though President Trump seems to characterize it as a transactional relationship. The relationship with Saudi Arabia, you know, started in 1945. They were instrumental in the Cold War and the fight against communism. They're instrumental in regulating the global oil market, which is a fungible and global market, which means that if any disruption happens in Saudi Arabia, even if we're entirely self-sufficient in the United States, we would feel the effects in terms of price immediately. they are fundamentally important, the Saudis, for the stability of the region, which has been a longstanding American interest in this part of the world. You also have Iran, you have Islam, you have the fight against the radical Islamists. The Saudis are instrumental, again, in fighting against radical Islamism, and in particular, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, because he has made it a policy of the kingdom to turn away from Islamism and towards nationalism and populism. And that, again, is very important for the United States, because if he succeeds in Saudi Arabia, that would set a pattern for the entire region.
Right.
So there are many reasons for this relationship, and it transcends either Trump or MBS.
I want to play a clip here on sort of how that tension is playing out amongst other leaders in Washington. On CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday, Republican Senator Marco Rubio said that the United States' relationship with Saudi Arabia goes beyond that $110 billion in arms deals we were talking about.
I would just say it's unfortunate, because Saudi Arabia is an important part of our Middle Eastern strategy. They are a key leverage and hedge point against Iranian influence in the region, but that cannot supersede our commitment to human rights.
Stephen Cook, what does the United States stand to lose, perhaps morally, if that's the right approach to take here, by this continuing close relationship with Saudi Arabia? I mean, we have listeners online who are talking to us about remembering the terrorists that came from Saudi Arabia after 9/11. And again, Yemen comes up over and over again. There's a 100-year famine that Yemen is facing, the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world right now, largely driven by the Saudi bombing there. I mean, does not the United States stand to lose something by, I don't want to call it an unquestioning relationship, but this so close and tight relationship?
Well, this is the central dilemma for American policymakers who want to secure America's security interests around the region, who want to fight the Islamic State, who want to counter Iranian influence. It has allies in the region who will do things that run counter to American values. And oftentimes with American policymakers overlooking it or with their blessing. This is something that outrages many people in the Middle East, many people who want to live in more open and democratic societies. That is that the difference between the way in which Americans live at home in our democratic institutions and our conduct abroad and who our allies are abroad. I think the problem is that the United States does not have the ability to alter these governments. We can choose not to work with these governments, but as Bernie pointed out, there are a number of compelling reasons why the United States has had a strategic relationship with Saudi Arabia. That's coming under question now. Actually, on both sides of the aisle here in Washington, D.C., there have been Republican and Democratic efforts to curtail Washington's support for the Saudi intervention in Yemen. I should say. So it is something that I think policymakers are wrestling with, but over and over we see calls for a foreign policy that is more consistent with American values, but security interests tend to win
out. Well, to the point you were just making, Stephen Cook, let me just play some tape here from Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake. He's a member of the Foreign Relations Committee. He was asked on ABC's This Week if the U.S. should stop arms sales with Saudi Arabia because of Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance.
I do think that arms sales will be affected. Certainly our involvement in Yemen with Saudi Arabia will be affected. That involvement barely survived in the last go around with the National Defense Authorization Act. It certainly won't survive with this kind of accusation if it is true.
Now, what Senator Flake is referring to there is that the original Senate-backed version of the 2018 National Defense Authorization Act banned the U.S. military from aiding or refueling, I should specifically say refueling, Saudi coalition airplanes involved in Yemen bombing, unless the Secretary of State had certified that the coalition was taking active measures to end the war and the humanitarian disaster in Yemen. The White House, however, strongly objected to that language, and the final compromise version of the bill did not put those conditions on the U.S. ability to refuel Saudi coalition warplanes. Well, let's go to a caller now. Samuel is calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Samuel, you're on the air.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and us here in the United States is a very strong and very fundamental one. However, you know, there's a difference between, you know, the deals made between the deciders, and also there's also a perception of the public, general public. Look, this, we are in a big, big trouble with this. Mm. There's no other way, no solution, than to do something that a common man in the street of Cairo, in the street of Amman, in the street of Beirut, in the street of Tel Aviv, in the street of Jerusalem, will see and say, see, okay, you know, we don't dare not go there.
I see. So are you saying, Samuel, are you saying the United States taking a very pointed diplomatic action, sanctions? What are you talking about?
Very visible diplomatic actions. For example, close the embassy, one or two places. Say, you know, you can only operate from there only until we see there's a change.
Mm-hmm.
Then the world will, you know, the record buyers, people will remember that something was done, even though it did not, you know, do what, you know, some people have in mind, and it will be satisfactory.
I see.
It will also help the Saudis.
Samuel, I'm just going to take it from you there because you made a really interesting point. I want to ask Bernard Haykel what he thinks about that. Interesting that Samuel says that he believes the United States should take action, very visible diplomatic action, that would resonate or communicate with, as he said, the people in the streets of not just Riyadh, but Cairo, Tel Aviv, et cetera. What do you think about that?
I mean, it may look good, you know, in copy in the press and so on. But in actual fact, I mean, that's not what's going to affect change in places like Saudi Arabia or other Middle Eastern countries where you have an authoritarian system. The U.S. has many other tools at its disposal, and it should think of those rather than, you know, symbolic gestures.
Uh-huh. Well, speaking of those tools, I'm seeing here now that U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham is saying that he believes Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had a U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi murdered in the Saudi consulate, and that that Salman has, quote, tainted his country as a result. This is from the Associated Press. Lindsey Graham is saying that the crown prince has, quote, got to go and that he will not return to Saudi Arabia while the prince is in power. Graham is also saying that he's been the, quote, biggest defender of the kingdom, but now he plans to, quote, sanction the hell out of Saudi Arabia. That's from the Associated Press. Stephen Cook, what do you think?
Well, Senator Graham has been an interesting commentator on the Middle East over many years because he has been forthright in speaking out on human rights and democracy promotion, especially in places like Egypt, though he's been relatively more quiet when it comes to Saudi Arabia. Again, the kind of very difficult issue and position that American policymakers are in when it comes to the importance of Saudi Arabia and having a foreign policy that is more consistent with American values. It's clear that the apparent killing of Jamal Khashoggi has moved him to be more critical and to include Saudi Arabia more forthrightly in his denunciations of authoritarianism and human rights violations in the region. The real question is, though, whether the kind of things that Senator Graham is talking about are really going to have an impact on the behavior of Saudi Arabia. Certainly, Congress has a variety of tools. As you heard Jeff Flake talking about suspending arms sales to Saudi Arabia, there's the Global Magnitsky Act, which would make certain Saudis, if they're sanctioned with it, unable to conduct business in the international financial system. But as we've seen from other cases, from Russia in particular, this has not altered the behavior of other countries.
Well, can I just we have a minute to go before the break. And Bernard Haykel, I want to get your thought on this, because as Stephen Cook was saying, would Saudi Arabia's behavior change, and specifically the behavior from the crown prince or the king, for as long as the president of the United States has shown that he does not necessarily have a bad word to say for authoritarian leaders in other countries, Russia, North Korea, Turkey?
Well, look, I mean, the Saudis have in the past extradited or kidnapped, if you like, dissidents and brought them back to Saudi Arabia, where they put them in prison. They're not in the habit of killing dissidents overseas. They've never done it, as far as I know. And so this is completely out of character. And I think that certainly this will never happen again. And they should account for it, and they should punish whoever's responsible for it. Mm. But I don't think that the Congress has that kind of influence on an ability to change Saudi behavior, certainly not domestic politics and changing who's the leader in the kingdom.
Well, we're speaking with Bernard Haykel. He's professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. And with Stephen Cook, he's senior fellow for Middle East and African Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we're talking about renewed scrutiny of the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about scrutiny of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. This is in the wake of the disappearance and reported killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. We're joined today by Stephen Cook. He's senior fellow for Middle East and African Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And by Bernard Haykel. He's professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. And let's go to some callers here. Dolores is calling from Waterford, Pennsylvania. You're on the air, Dolores.
Hi, Meghna, and hello to your guests. Before I have a couple of questions, I'd like to make a point. If anyone wants to get some good insight into the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, they need to read Manal El-Sharif's book, Daring to Drive. It's a good insight. It's a good read, and it provides an eye-opening exposure to how these guys operate. Now, here's my question. I mean, who in their right mind is going to believe that this was conducted by a rogue element? You had an individual show up with a bone saw. To me, that's a signal you intended to conduct some sort of nefarious act. Mm. This had been premeditated. And my other point is...
Dolores, let me jump in here for a second. So those reports so far, the only sources for those reports are Turkish officials, unnamed Turkish officials. So that hasn't actually been independently confirmed yet. Just want to remind folks of that. But go ahead.
Okay, and here, Donald Trump is the one who has claimed that the media is the enemy of the people. And I am only speculating, of course, because I don't have evidence, but... In my mind, as I'm looking at this, and you have, the world's leader claiming that the media is the enemy of the people. I mean, in MBS's circle, they think, we can take this guy out. Who's going to care?
Mm.
I mean, I personally think Trump could care less about Khashoggi, and that interview on the White House lawn yesterday was, another act. It's another lie. I mean, I am hoping that Congress... get some intestinal fortitude here and can do something.
Yeah.
And it show these global dictators that maybe they have a friend in Donald Trump, a gift in Donald Trump, but that the U.S. Congress is going to start taking some action against these human rights violations that are occurring around the globe.
Well, Dolores, thank you for your call. Stephen Cook, let me turn that to you. First of all, to Dolores's assertion that the president's own rhetoric against journalists may have emboldened folks like the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and this is something that has been part of the commentary since the first reported missing of Jamal Khashoggi. And I think that certainly it's unfortunate that the president refers to the press as the enemy of the people. It certainly underscores for dictators around the world that the White House will downplay attacks on the media. But let's also be clear, people like Vladimir Putin, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, others around the world, the Chinese, are arresting journalists, harming journalists. So one can imagine that if this decision was made at the highest levels in Saudi Arabia, they looked around the world and they saw how the Russians are killing people in small British towns, in DuPont Circle, Washington, D.C., DuPont Circle hotels. The Chinese are rounding up people. Turkey is the leading jailer of journalists in the world. None of those countries have paid a price for that, and that Saudis must have believed that they wouldn't pay a price either. So I think, yes, in part, it does have to do with President Trump's rhetoric. But I also think it is an international environment that transcends President Trump.
Okay, so I'm going to explore that a little more in a second, specifically regarding some of the things that Khashoggi himself has said about Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. But Stephen Cook, there was a point that you mentioned much early in the program that I should have dug deeper into, and that is, how much does the president's personal business interests in Saudi Arabia, first of all, what are they specifically, and how much do you think that is influencing his approach to this current diplomatic crisis?
Well, there's all kinds of allegations concerning the president and his family's business ties with Gulf monarchies. I'm not aware that there's a Trump International Hotel in Riyadh, but there are extensive links between the Trump organizations and countries all over the world. And this is a continuing question whether the president is making decisions based on his family's personal financial interests or on behalf of the United States. We do know that the government of Qatar, through an investment fund, has invested in a building in New York City that was in tremendous debt that's owned by the Kushner companies. Qatar and Saudi Arabia are at odds. So there is a lot of different business interests, and it's very, very hard to pinpoint specifically how the president is making decision on these issues. I think any president in the United States would be in a tremendously awkward position with allegations coming from a NATO ally like Turkey that the Saudis, a strategic ally in the Middle East, had murdered someone in their consulate in Turkey's, you know, main city. How the president would respond to that, anybody occupying the Oval Office would be trying to weigh how much to emphasize values and freedom of the press and protections for the press versus relationships with a country like Saudi Arabia.
Well, and look, the Saudis spend a lot of money in Washington, right? The Washington Post is reporting that Saudi Arabia plowed $27 million into lobbying in Washington just last year, making it one of the highest spending countries seeking to influence U.S. policy. That's according to public records. Well, let's take another call here. Saeed is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Saeed, you're on the air.
Hello. I am calling to ring an alarm bell on overreaction to the Khashoggi situation in terms of bending to the political, domestic political forces and international Middle Eastern countries themselves, the greatest violators of human rights, who are trying to exploit this situation in order to affect American foreign policy. I remind us of a similar situation we were in 1976, where the emerging new American president, Jimmy Carter, made human rights the central piece of his foreign policy, placing pressure on the then Shah of Iran on his human rights record, resulting in his displacement and the conversion of a close American ally that Iran was then to the greatest American foe, and a significant deterioration of human rights in Iran, resulting in over 1 million Iranians dead, 7 million in exile, and 70 million living under tyranny. This is what happens when American foreign policy treats human rights as the sole endpoint and does not understand the strategic dimensions that are involved in that in our relations.
Saeed, thank you for your call. Bernard Haeckel, how do you respond to Saeed?
Well, I think he makes a good point, and the story that he tells about Iran is certainly true. I think that the point that he's trying to make as far as Saudi Arabia is concerned is that there is a very important strategic relationship here. That the states that are engaged in, let's say, the Turks with their campaign of leaks, some of which may be disinformation. We don't know whether they're true or not. The Turks are allies with the Qataris, who hate the Saudis. The Turks and the Saudis are rivals. The Iranians are rivals to the Saudis. So one has to be really careful in coming to conclusions about what to do as a result of this tragic episode. I think that the most important thing is to focus on, if a crime was committed, to get people punished for the crime, but not to jeopardize the relationship that we have, that the United States has with its strategic allies in the region, because the repercussions of, let's say, undermining Saudi Arabia and causing the weakening of the regime there could be a civil war. And let's not forget that in the Middle East, we have four or five failed states with lots of wars raging. And a similar one, God forbid, in Saudi Arabia would lead us to a military intervention possibly in this region. And that's not something we want to get involved with at all.
I mean, I think one of the constant stories of U.S. involvement in the Middle East is actions taken for what seem to be strategically positive reasons at the time, but that yield long-term consequences that come back to haunt the United States. I mean, speaking of Iran and Jimmy Carter, the reason why the Shah was there to begin with was that the United States helped depose Mossadegh in the 1950s after Iran nationalized its oil fields. And then we got the Shah, and then we got the Iranian Revolution. So it's a long, ongoing story of this complex relationship between the United States and the entire region. But specifically regarding Saudi Arabia, I just want to play a little bit of tape here from Jamal Khashoggi himself, because he was actually on this program on Point last November, and he criticized Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's tactics for cracking down on corruption within the Saudi government. So here's Khashoggi.
One man rule always lead to a disaster. Mohammed bin Salman is doing the right things the wrong way. Saudi Arabia need fixing, but he need proper advisors around him. He need to expand involving the people in decision making by allowing some form of democracy, some form of power sharing through an elective body. So we have to have that at the near future, otherwise one man rule will lead to a disaster.
That is Jamal Khashoggi, the dissident and journalist who was missing in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, reportedly killed there as well. He was on Point last November. Stephen Cook, how threatening or dangerous is what you heard from Khashoggi there, when him calling for some form of democracy in Saudi Arabia, that one-man rule will lead to a disaster in Saudi Arabia? I mean, those were pointed criticisms about the crown prince of the country.
Well, in the grand scheme of criticisms, it was actually somewhat mild. I think he said in that clip that he agreed that Saudi Arabia needed fixing and that the crown prince was doing things that were, in theory, good, but doing it in the wrong way. But I think that the call for democracy, the calls for the kind of reform, this runs counter to the worldview of someone like Mohammed bin Salman. Just recently, in an interview that the crown prince did with Bloomberg Businessweek, he said, "I've never claimed that I'm a reformer. I'm the crown prince of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia." And I think that when the crown prince looks at Saudi Arabia and its problems, I think he has perceived that the way to rule Saudi Arabia is not like previous kings, in which there was kind of a grand bargain among major constituents of the House of Saud, but who needed to accumulate as much power to kind of break the vested interests that have brought Saudi Arabia to this point where its economy is irrational, it doesn't work very well, it doesn't evolve, it has not produced commensurate with its wealth. And his view was, I need to accumulate as much power as possible in order to transform it. But I think it may very well be, as Jamal Khashoggi said in that clip, quite prophetic, that one-man rule brings on disaster.
Well, but Stephen Cook, Bernard Haykel was saying just a couple of minutes ago that the United States doesn't want to push Saudi Arabia in the direction of possibly, you know, fomenting instability within the kingdom itself, because the last thing the region needs is another civil war. I mean, is that even possible, given the power that the House of Saud has there?
I think that the United States certainly doesn't want to push these kinds of reforms on Saudi Arabia. I think they're haunted by President Carter's position on Iran in the 1970s. I think American policymakers fear that would cause a tremendous instability in Saudi Arabia. I don't think we have enough of a handle on whether it would produce a civil war or not. But it is certainly a fear that concerns successive generations of American foreign policymakers about the stability of Saudi Arabia. And one can imagine, given that fear and given the history of the United States and what happened in Iran in 1979, that the United States would be more proactive in trying to help the House of Saud prevent something rather than the position the Obama administration took with regard to the uprising in Egypt, where they were perfectly willing to sit by as a longtime ally was removed from office.
Right.
I don't think that would be the same situation when it came to Saudi Arabia.
Well, Bernard Haykel, we've spent this hour exploring why the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia is as complicated as it is. So given all that, and the agreement I'm hearing throughout this hour that nevertheless we are at a critical juncture regarding that relationship, I mean, what would you recommend? What do you think? How do you think the Trump administration should respond right now?
Well, I think that the Trump administration is responding well. I mean, first, the conversation he had with the king, that the president had with the king, sending the Secretary of State over there. And hopefully the Secretary of State is telling them, you know, you have to come up with a credible, truthful narrative of what happened. And you should have people, whoever they may be, be punished for what happened, if indeed you are involved in this and you have killed him. So I think it's very important to push in that direction. But I also think it's important for the Trump administration to calm the Saudi leadership, which feels, you know, terribly, abandoned by the West, and to tell them that, you know, you need to reform, but you need to also, you know, do things rationally and properly and build systems for accountability and build systems for decision making that are taken properly. I mean, of course, that coming from the Trump administration is going to be a tall order, given that, you know, we know that in the Trump administration, decisions aren't necessarily taken in that way.
Well, Stephen Cook, we've got about 30 seconds left. I mean, same question to you. The Khashoggi family is calling for an independent investigation. Would that be a start?
I think that's an important thing. Neither the Turkish government nor the Saudi government have much credibility in this area. So some type of international investigation, the cooperation of the FBI, something along those lines, I think, is warranted here.
And then following that, sanctions from the United States?
I think it's unlikely, but I think, as Bernie said, the United States government needs to impress upon their Saudi counterparts about accountability and reforming and doing things in a more rational kind of way.
Well, Stephen Cook is Senior Fellow for Middle East and African Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We have a link to his recent article for Foreign Policy. It's titled, Jamal Khashoggi's Disappearance is Even Stranger Than It Seems. That link is at onpointradio.org. Stephen Cook, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Megan.
And Bernard Haykel, Professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University and Director of Princeton's Institute for Transregional Study of the Contemporary Middle East. Professor Haykel, thank you as well.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.